journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free of all minds. These are weapons of mass dissent.
These are weapons of mass dissent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Friday, November 21st, 2008, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think.
Silence is not an option.
An update on the ongoing political impasse and humanitarian crisis in Zimbabwe, and some potentially good news coming out of Washington, D.C. with Tom Daschle and Henry Waxman to lead on health and the environment, plus Glenn Ford.
But I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Prompted by the ongoing political crisis in Zimbabwe, the government of South Africa announced that it will be withholding millions of dollars of agricultural aid to the country. In a statement released yesterday, South Africa's cabinet strongly suggested that, quote, no amount of political disagreement can ever justify the suffering that ordinary Zimbabweans are being subjected to at the moment. After disputed elections earlier this year, a power-sharing deal signed on to in September by Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe and his chief political rival Morgan Tsvangirai of the Movement for Democratic Change has nearly disintegrated. The agreement called for a twin cabinet structure, which quickly became a source of disagreement when Mugabe appointed a number of important ministries to members of his own ZANU-PF party. The recent outbreak of cholera in Zimbabwe, which has claimed 160 lives by some estimates, was cited in the strongly worded South African statement as a humanitarian consequence of a continuing political impasse over constitutional and cabinet positions within a unity government. While former South African President Thabo Mbeki has invited Mugabe and Tsvangirai to negotiate next week, a humanitarian mission headed by former President of the United States, Jimmy Carter, Kofi Annan, former UN Secretary General, and Graca Machel will be going to Zimbabwe this Saturday to assess the economic and humanitarian crisis. My guest is Briggs Bamba, a Zimbabwean-born economist working for Africa Action in Washington, D.C. He joins us on the phone right now. Welcome back to Uprising, Briggs.
Thank you, Sonali.
Hi, thanks so much for joining us. I know you're joining us via cell phone as you're stuck in an airport waiting to head out to a conference, so we appreciate you joining us. We had talked to you before, and it's been a while since we've covered the situation in Zimbabwe. Since then, a lot has happened. Some might say that Zimbabwe has come closer to reconciling between the Mugabe and Tsvangirai factions, but others might say, well, no real progress has been made. Can you assess for us how close or far the Zimbabwean government is at this moment to reaching some kind of reconciliation between these two parties?
The political stalemate still continues. On 15 September, the three parties signed the Global Political Agreement, which mandated the formation of a government of national unity. But there's still intense mistrust amongst the parties, particularly between the Movement for Democratic Change led by Morgan Tsvangirai and ZANU-PF led by Robert Mugabe, to the extent that it's making it impossible for them to agree on any single thing moving forward, including the allocation of ministries. But even if that were to be done, because of deep running mistrust between these parties, and also because of lack of a shared vision between these two parties, you still have this political stalemate going on. But at the same time, I want to say as well that we may actually be reaching a breaking point, because the humanitarian crisis in the country has degenerated to levels that were unimaginable over, let's say 2-3 months ago. You have cholera affecting 9 of the 10 provinces. You have a complete breakdown in the education system, complete breakdown in the healthcare system. So the humanitarian crisis is at its worst ever, and I think that's going to build pressure to bring the parties to this dialogue, to some sort of an agreement and a consensus on moving forward.
Now, Briggs, I talk about bringing the two parties together, but at the same time, I think some background is in order in terms of the legitimacy of the Mugabe government to even have any power right now.
Yes, as your listeners will recall, March 29, Zimbabwe had an election, and the 57% of the Zimbabwean voters voted against President Mugabe. And that's an election that was deemed to be free and fair by the regional body, SADC, and other international observer missions. And then following that election, you then had a very seriously contested presidential election on June 27, which the opposition boycotted, but Mugabe went on to claim victory over. So it is true that at this point, President Mugabe does not have a popular mandate to be holding on to power. The other fact, though, that needs to be considered is that when you look at the key forces that are determining the political landscape in Zimbabwe, Mugabe still has significant support, particularly amongst the war veterans, who are people who fought for the liberation of the country in the 70s, and also amongst the military brass, and also amongst certain sections of the rural populace. So this is these are the social forces or the pillars which he is bringing onto the table. And these pillars, particularly his control of the coercive apparatus of the state, the police, the army, the secret services, which makes him a factor. So it's true that he does not have legitimacy, but moving forward, is a factor that cannot be ignored.
Now, Briggs, the way in which the ministries have been distributed in this so-called power-sharing deal between the two rivals speaks volumes again about how Mugabe is planning on moving forward. Can you talk about the significance of Morgan Tsvangirai's party being saddled with the terrible, terrible state of the Zimbabwean economy?
Yes, so I think the first thing we need to understand is how ZANU-PF has been surviving over the last decade. It has survived by mostly two things. One is patronage, and for patronage, you need control over the resource of the country, control over the mining interests, over agricultural interests, because it's those handouts that have been passed through and then which have bought loyalty. And this is why in these ongoing negotiations about ministries, ZANU-PF is very reluctant to surrender, let's say, the Ministry of Mines or the Ministry of Agriculture, because it's that patronage system that has kept them in place. And then the second thing is outright coercion. And for coercion, you need to control the security forces. You need to control the police. You need to control the army. You need to control the secret service. So, again, you have seen a total unwillingness and total intransigence on the part of Mugabe to relinquish control of the police or the Ministry of Home Affairs to the extent of risking a complete breakdown of the negotiations. So, on the other hand, you have seen the opposition being saddled with the social ministries, ministries that are expected to deliver, ministries that are expected to start building the roads that have collapsed, the infrastructure that have been destroyed in healthcare, in education, basically the ministries that are supposed to deliver on the most urgent questions of poverty and the humanitarian crisis that the population is facing. So it's a very tricky situation for the opposition right now.
So basically, Morgan Tsvangirai is left to pick up the pieces of the ruin that the country's infrastructure and economy has faced under Mugabe.
He's being invited to change diapers for Mugabe's regime, basically.
That's a good way of putting it. My guest is Briggs Bamba, and he joins us on the phone right now. He is a Zimbabwean-born economist working with Africa Action, and we're talking about the ongoing political impasse and humanitarian crisis in Zimbabwe. Now, what is the significance of South Africa's actions that I mentioned earlier in the introduction to your, to this interview? Given that South Africa has long been a strong ally of Zimbabwe, does this also indicate a final sort of change in the direction where Mugabe's international solidarity is concerned?
So South Africa for the longest time has acted in complicity with the regime in Harare. If you see the conduct that former President Thabo Mbeki handled himself with, the way he handled the negotiations since he's been involved with the Zimbabwe question, it has been in a way that short to ensure that there's no total transformation in Zimbabwe, but there's a negotiated settlement in which ZANU-PF retains significant amount of power, and this is also partly because they do not trust the opposition so much. And with the changes that we've seen in South Africa now, with the coming in of Motlanthe as the new president, you are seeing a change in tone and a change in attitude in South Africa. But I must mention that it is not anywhere near the decisive, solid position that has been expected for a long time by, you know, ordinary Zimbabweans and other people in the Southern African community. Now South Africa has said that they will not release the $28 million US dollars that they'd committed to finance Zimbabwe's agriculture this year until there's a political settlement. But you are not hearing them speak on why isn't there a political settlement. In the last discussions that were chaired by President Motlanthe, President Mugabe refused to recuse himself when SADC was about to make a judgment on the allocation of ministries in Zimbabwe, and no one came out to raise that in any serious and in any solid way. So Motlanthe is different from Thabo Mbeki, but he's nowhere near giving the principled position that the people of Zimbabwe have been expecting.
What about the delegation of the elders, as they're being called, Jimmy Carter and others, into Zimbabwe, despite being told that they're not welcome? What does that signify, you think?
I think it's going to be a very difficult situation for the Mugabe regime to handle, because if they proceed with the trip, as they have said they will, it will create very serious controversy, and it will work against the image that Harare is trying to portray if they are going to manhandle President Carter, Secretary General Kofi Annan, and Graca Machel at the airport and refuse them entry into Zimbabwe. So I think their trip will be very significant in exposing the way things are done in Harare, particularly the way that it has become a very inaccessible place, the way that simple freedoms are not, you know, respected. So it will be a very significant thing if they go there, and if they are not allowed to go into the country, the world will learn a lot from it still.
Now, Briggs, you are on your way to a conference called the State of the Black World in New Orleans this weekend. Do you think that Zimbabwe, which is, of course, a country that had very much been a part of discussions on the left for decades regarding anti-colonial struggles, will Zimbabwe be a point of discussion at the conference, you think? And is there any kind of consensus developing on the black left about Robert Mugabe's tenure?
It will be a point of discussion, but unfortunately it will also be a point of serious disagreement, because there's still a lack of consensus on how to approach Mugabe's rhetoric of anti-imperialism, his program on land redistribution, and further confusing the situation as well is the relationship that the opposition in Zimbabwe has established with certain forces that are not trusted by the black left, particularly the old farming community in Zimbabwe and certain, you know, European powers as well. So it's a very complicated situation, and that we are not anywhere near having, you know, a total consensus. But I must say that attitudes have been shifting as well, particularly when cases of human rights abuses became more and more evident from Zimbabwe. You have seen certain voices, progressive voices on the left, saying, you know, it's not worth abusing your people to this extent just to prove a point.
Well, that's at least encouraging to note. But Briggs, at this point, what do you think the role of the left ought to be, or just in general, those who want to see human rights respected all across the world, in Zimbabwe in particular, what can be done from outside, or does it have to be sort of left to international diplomats to try to talk Mugabe out of this madness?
So I think the left internationally is most well-positioned to be able to expose the emptiness of Mugabe's rhetoric on anti-colonialism, on anti-imperialism, which has been used to cover up human rights abuses, corruption, and various other violations of our people's, you know, democratic rights in Zimbabwe. So the left, because the left has a credibility that the National Democratic Institute or the International Republican Institute does not have. And sadly, these are the institutions that have been most expressed and loudest in talking about the Zimbabwe situation. So the left has to speak up and seize the space that appears to have been picked up right now by a lot of these conservative voices who do not really have credibility to talk about cases in Africa, particularly because of their very controversial history in interventions on the continent. So I think the left is the one that is most well-positioned to come and speak about human rights at this time, come and speak about a true anti-imperialist agenda in this time, and expose President Mugabe for the rhetoric that he has been using over the last decade.
Briggs Bamba, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Are there any websites you'd like to recommend where listeners can get more information?
Sure. For our website, www.africaaction.org. And thank you for having me on your program.
That's africaaction.org. Briggs Bamba, thanks so much. Briggs Bamba is a Zimbabwean-born economist working for Africa Action in Washington, D.C. He recommends africaaction.org for more information. We've been talking about the situation in Zimbabwe. And later in the hour, we're going to be speaking with a representative from Greenpeace to comment on the recent appointment of Henry Waxman, California Democrat, to the chair of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. We'll also hear this week's Black Agenda report. And after the subversive historian, Tom Daschle has been picked by Obama as Secretary of Health and Human Services. We'll find out what that means. You're listening to Uprising. We'll be right back.
Red Nation Celebration presents the third annual American Indian Heritage Month in the city of Los Angeles. Celebrate American Indian culture, heritage, tradition. The day before Thanksgiving, plant a tree in respect to our ancestors and future generations at the American Indian Holocaust Memorial and Grand Entry Parade, the only American Indian Holocaust Memorial in the country. Held at the Los Angeles State Historic Park on November 26th at 11 a.m. For more information, contact info@rednation.com or call 818-904-9256. Red Nation Celebration, where culture meets community.
That's the American Indian Holocaust Memorial and Parade, the day before Thanksgiving. For more information, call 818-904-9256.
Don't forget your history. This is Gabriel San Roman, your subversive historian. 81 years ago on this day in people's history, the Columbine Mine Massacre occurred in Colorado. On November 21, 1927, striking miners were met with the gunfire of state police, leaving six laborers dead. Hundreds of workers had gathered on that fateful morning in an effort to join the statewide strike called by the Industrial Workers of the World. After weeks of picketing, the confrontation soon began near the mines of Serene, Colorado, just 15 miles north of Denver. The state police, dressed in civilian clothes and heavily armed, tried to fortify a gated entrance of the town, but the strikers decided to rush and overwhelm it. The ensuing bloodshed highlighted the tensions of the industry at the time, as the state police fired into the crowd of workers, their wives, and children. As for redressing the violence, the governor of Colorado did nothing of the like, as he absolved the state police forces of all wrongdoing and blamed the miners. Surprise, surprise. For Uprising, this is your truth, Professor Sane. It's no mystery why they conceal our history.
Welcome back to Uprising. Former Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle has been offered the position of Secretary of Health and Human Services by President-elect Barack Obama and has accepted. Daschle has been a vocal supporter of healthcare reform, authoring a book about it earlier this year called Critical: What We Can Do About the Healthcare Crisis. Obama's campaign position on healthcare reform, quote, builds on the existing healthcare system and uses existing providers, doctors, and plans. The president-elect often stated his plan plainly during debates and speeches. While he promises to take health insurance companies to task, he has also shied away from single-payer government-run health care. Universal health care, a cornerstone of former President Bill Clinton's presidential campaign, failed to make progress under his tenure. With a majority of Americans unhappy with the current healthcare system, it remains to be seen what Obama and Daschle may be able to achieve. My guest this morning is Michael Leite. He is Director of Administration and Public Policy at the California Nurses Association and the National Nurses Organizing Committee. Welcome to Uprising, Michael.
Thank you very much.
Now, your organization has taken a very strong, uncompromising position on Medicare for All, the a system of government-run health care. Of course, the Obama administration has not really adopted that. But how optimistic are you about the Daschle appointment?
We are optimistic about the Daschle appointment because he is someone who gets it. He gets that we can't just reform financing, that we have to change the whole healthcare industry into a healthcare system and make it a coherent system that will actually meet the needs of people who live in this country. And he also gets it that we have to address healthcare disparities, particularly among low-income and people of color, which, of course, derive from social determinants of health. And we've been optimistic that we will be able to get a meeting with Senator Daschle and to really convince him that single payer, which he understands as well, as does the president-elect, is the only approach that is publicly administered and publicly financed health care, guaranteed to everyone, is the only approach that's actually going to solve the problem. And we're going to focus on that as the solution.
Well, let's take a listen to what Barack Obama has said about health care under his campaign, during his campaign, and what he would like to bring during his administration.
Here's what my plan does. If you have health insurance, then you don't have to do anything. If you've got health insurance through your employer, you can keep your health insurance, keep your choice of doctor, keep your plan. The only thing we're going to try to do is lower costs, so that those cost savings are passed on to you. And we estimate we can cut the average family's premium by about $2,500 per year. If you don't have health insurance, then what we're going to do is to provide you the option of buying into the same kind of federal pool that both Senator McCain and I enjoy as federal employees, which will give you high-quality care, choice of doctors, at lower cost because so many people are part of this insured group. We're going to make sure that insurance companies can't discriminate on the basis of pre-existing conditions. We'll negotiate with the drug companies for the cheapest available price on drugs. We are going to invest in information technology to eliminate bureaucracy and make the system more efficient. And we are going to make sure that we manage chronic illnesses like diabetes and heart disease that cost a huge amount but could be prevented. We've got to put more money into preventive care.
And that's President-elect Barack Obama. This was him speaking during the third presidential debate alongside John McCain. Some of the things, of course, Michael, that he said were wonderful in terms of, you know, preventing health insurance companies from excluding people because of pre-existing conditions, preventative health care, cutting out bureaucracy, etc. But if you go to his website, he says on health care reform, this is on change.gov, on health care reform, the American people are too often offered two extremes, government-run healthcare with higher taxes or letting the insurance companies operate without rules. So he characterizes your position, government-run healthcare, as an extreme.
Well, we would, of course, disagree with that because the problem is that the private health insurance-based reform that the president-elect promotes in that quote is something he knows very well is not the best approach. He said to the AFL-CIO Civil and Human Rights Conference in 2003 that he's a supporter of single payer. He said more recently that if he were starting from scratch, he would implement single payer, publicly financed and administered, mostly privately delivered health care. The problem is that the goals that he establishes in terms of lowering costs, controlling insurance company behavior, cannot be achieved through his reform proposal. And that no matter what, the health insurers are essentially lining up to get a bailout. And that bailout would come in the form of an individual mandate for everyone to buy private health insurance. They would then be able to determine who doesn't need health care and then give them insurance, even under a community rating approach, even under the kind of approach that would not allow them to discriminate on pre-existing conditions. They can always find a way to make sure that those that they give insurance to are not ones who actually need health care. They also waste, of course, 20 to 35% of every health care dollar in marketing and profits, and then billing departments and hospitals and doctors waste huge amounts of money trying to get reimbursement from those health insurance companies. Moreover, that federal plan that the president-elect talks about is a consortium of 260 individual health plans. That's not the kind of choice people want. That's just confusion, that's just duplication, that's just waste. The choice that ordinary folks want is, can I go to the doctor when I need health care? And that guarantee is simply not going to be achieved through a private health insurance industry-based reform.
Well, so let's talk about Tom Daschle's appointment. I mean, there is some criticism and very valid criticism of Obama's other appointments on, you know, such as Rahm Emanuel and others, on particularly on foreign policy, in the foreign policy arena. But you think that Tom Daschle may be going in the right direction. What are his credentials, aside from, you know, the book that he authored? What are his credentials on healthcare reform, and you know, how close are you to being able to have him, you know, sit down with you, with your organization, and actually hash out a real plan for change?
Well, we're optimistic that we will be able to get a meeting with him. What Senator Daschle has done in the last couple of years, as he was researching that book, is he actually got very familiar with the reality of American healthcare from the patient's perspective. He worked with people like Donna Smith, who was in the Michael Moore film Sicko. He reached out to caregivers on the front lines in hospitals, and he didn't just work with academics from that perspective. And so that's really what he brings, is a better base of knowledge and sensitivity to the actual realities of patients and caregivers as they try to navigate a very dysfunctional industry that's not a coherent system. And, of course, he was in Congress and the majority leader of the Senate at the time that health care was a key issue. So he obviously has that experience, not a positive outcome, obviously. So we just think that if he's going to play this role as health czar as well as health and human services secretary, that's a good sign about how important the administration takes comprehensive health care reform. And with someone with his knowledge about the realities of healthcare, that's a good combination. And what is the problem in Washington is that politics are too much driving this healthcare debate, because what some of the proposals are trying to do is buy off the private health insurers rather than actually implement the policy that's going to solve the crisis. And we think Senator Daschle is someone who wants to solve the crisis. And in Washington, ironically, that policy emphasis over just whatever's, you know, seen to be the easiest way politically, that difference is huge.
What was the role of this position, Health and Human Services Secretary, under the Bush administration? How was it used or perhaps misused?
Well, this was, of course, the agency that would, via the Centers for Medicare, would implement the various privatization schemes and regulatory schemes that have undermined Medicare as it exists today.
And the position, by the way, being held by Michael Levitt since 2005.
Yeah, exactly. Levitt is the one directly responsible, but of course this is the agency. And then secondly, this is the agency that is restricting women's right to choose and is the one that would most recently put forth regulations that would allow more hospital caregivers to not participate in abortion services, really restricting the availability of those services in many rural areas in particular. So that's they've used it as a kind of place where their social conservative agenda can be implemented in healthcare. That's been very problematic.
In one of the debates in particular, Barack Obama took a very strong position on women's reproductive health, since you just mentioned that, particularly compared to John McCain, and he certainly also won a majority of women's votes in the election. What is Tom Daschle's position on women's reproductive health?
My understanding is that he's a strong supporter of choice and women accessing health services, and he's also very concerned about the disparity of access and costs that women incur trying to access those services. We had that recent study, a good example of the private health insurers being an inadequate vehicle for actually delivering health care, where they actually charge women more for health insurance policies that provide the same benefits to men. And so even though the benefits are comparable, the cost to women are higher. That's the kind of disparity that Senator Daschle understands is unacceptable.
My guest is Michael Leite, Director of Administration and Public Policy at California Nurses Association and the National Nurses Organizing Committee. And we're talking about the appointment of former Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle to the position of Secretary of Health and Human Services by Barack Obama. Daschle has accepted the offer. There is a small point that the New York Times has raised. Well, maybe it's not such a small point, about conflict of interest, which Barack Obama has made it, has taken a very strong ethical position on. But now many are pointing to Tom Daschle, who was very closely advising Barack Obama during the campaign and is now being offered this position, that this appointment could be a violation of the conflict of interest ethical pledge that Barack Obama has taken. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I think that on the one hand, the president-elect is exactly right. I mean, the influence of lobbyists and political action committees is just overwhelming in Washington. And so we've got to eliminate those kinds of conflicts. If someone's been an advisor on policy during the campaign and then you want to bring him into the administration to play a role in those areas, to me that doesn't sound like a conflict. I think that the president-elect should have the right to bring in people who he's convinced can do a good job in those policy areas. If there is a real financial conflict even like Eric Holder, for example, the possible attorney general nominee, he's represented Merck. I'd be far more concerned about that.
Good point. Well, finally, Michael, I mentioned earlier that Bill Clinton tried and failed to bring about health care reform in his presidency, but many are saying that Barack Obama will be able to succeed precisely because the climate is right, because so many Americans are so fed up of the failing health care system. So many are being thrown into bankruptcy because of health problems, and the system is just so broken that this is the perfect time. Do you concur?
I do. I think there's a real momentum for change. I think that the fact that health insurance premiums have gone up over 90% in the last 6 years or so, I think there's a huge demand for change, and that's really the opening for those of us who advocate Medicare for All, is that our approach actually solves the problem, unlike these other proposals. And when they're compared apples to apples as to what actually is going to address the needs of people in this country, we're going to prevail. And we in a debate on policy and on a debate on what actually works, we can win.
Well, Barack Obama has certainly said that he welcomes people's input and welcomes their ideas, so and seems to be open to pressure, at least in theory. So certainly people can who agree with the National Nurses Organizing Committee can certainly pressure the Obama campaign to take up the position of Medicare for All if they think that's the right one. Michael Leite, where can listeners find out more about the plan that your organization proposes?
GuaranteedHealthcare.org is our website, or they can go to calnurses.org and hear about our organization as well. And we really welcome that participation because it's up to us to build a movement that moves President Obama to do the right thing.
GuaranteedHealthcare.org and calnurses.org are the websites that Michael recommends. Michael, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. It was great to be on.
Michael Leite is Director of Administration and Public Policy at California Nurses Association and National Nurses Organizing Committee. And if you missed those websites, you can just check our website later today for links at kpfk.org/uprising. You are listening to Uprising, and after this week's Black Agenda Report, we'll take a look at Henry Waxman's new job. Stay tuned.
Artist, revolutionary, a woman ahead of her time, Mexican painter Frida Kahlo knew how to make a statement in more ways than one. In celebration of her storied life, El Centro Cultural de México proudly presents the Frida Festival. Taking place on November 22nd at the historic Yos Theater in downtown Santa Ana, the event will feature a multimedia lecture on the life of the legendary Mexican artist by international lecturer and former director of the Museum of Latin American Art, Gregorio Luque. Through Kahlo's personal letters and diaries, Luque will be going beyond the well-known image of the artist in both his Spanish matinee presentation at 3 p.m. and his English presentation at 8 p.m. In the evening, the Frida Festival will feature a performance by the Los Angeles-based Latin-flavored musical group La Santa Cecilia. Local artists and vendors will also be present in commemorating Kahlo's life. That's the Frida Festival on November 22nd, taking place at the historic Yos Theater located at 307 North Spurgeon Street in Santa Ana. For more information, call Calacas at 714-662-2002. That's 714-662-2002.
Glenn Ford is a writer and radio commentator and the executive editor of the Black Agenda Report. This week's commentary is called Lawless Capital Rushing to Armageddon.
The fundamental law of capital, the system's need to extract by any means possible ever-increasing returns on investment or die, brought the world to the current catastrophe. Inevitably, despite all the noise about the need for transparency and tightening of regulations on the behavior of capital, the system's response to its crisis is to descend into even greater depths of lawlessness. The frenzy of unchecked illegality pulsates outward from the chaotic center of crisis and criminality, Wall Street, which has succeeded in establishing a kind of privatized martial law economic regime in the waning months of Bush's kleptocracy. The $700 billion bailout is revealed as a brazen bait-and-switch bamboozlement in which Goldman Sachs family don Hank Paulson, under color of law as Treasury Secretary, ignores the terms of congressional legislation to dispense mountains of public wealth to his bankster friends as he sees fit. In return for their cut of the loot, the banking mafia give the public nothing. No recycling of the billions into loans for small business or college-bound students or any of the intended beneficiaries. Instead, the lords of capital hijacked the people's money to expand their territory, buying up the turf of smaller banksters in order to make themselves more indispensable, more untouchable, more removed from the elementary rule of law. Paulson attaches no strings of public obligations to his gifts, demands no voting stakeholder position in the banks. Then, the master criminal, in secrecy and with total contempt for a spineless and utterly compromised Congress, rewrites the laws of the land to forgive $140 billion in taxes due from the bank's merger deals, accomplished with the public's money. But Congress fails to protest this theft of its core legislative duty to make the laws that govern society. Paulson and his banksters are above the law, mega thieves operating with total impunity. Meanwhile, Paulson's partner in crime at the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, has distributed $2 trillion in loans to a list of corporations whose identities are secret for purposes that are also secret. Even the billionaire Michael Bloomberg's news agency is in the dark and has sued to find out where the $2,000 billion has gone. Few lawmakers on Capitol Hill seem to even want to know, fearing they'd be blamed for the panic that might break out if the public were aware of who had pocketed their trillions. If there is one person who possesses the moral capital to demand an accounting from the conspirators, it is Barack Obama. But the president-elect behaves as if it's none of his business if the Bush gang loots the national wealth on its way out. But then, Obama fought for the bailout, has had the kindest words for Paulson, and gets his economic advice from Robert Rubin, a former Goldman Sachs godfather and Treasury Secretary, and from Larry Summers, another former Treasury chief who teamed with Rubin during the Clinton administration to cast a cloak of silence over questions surrounding derivatives, the exotic financial instruments that finally wrecked the global system. Obama says he wants a smooth transition, but his silence on the lawlessness at the heart of that transition calls his own motives, competence, and integrity into question. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
Visit www.blackagendareport.com for more information. Welcome back to Uprising. Yesterday, California Democrat Henry Waxman ousted his fellow Democrat John Dingell from the influential post of House Energy and Commerce Committee chair. Dingell, who represents Michigan and is a staunch supporter of the auto industry, played a leading role for two decades as chairman in staving off environmental adaptations for American vehicles, such as fuel efficiency and lowering greenhouse gas emissions from cars. In appointing Waxman to the post by a 137-122 vote, Democrats are empowering a congressman with hefty green-friendly credentials. While environmental groups are celebrating the change, stock prices of the big three automakers, GM, Ford, and Chrysler, fell in response to the news. My guest is Stephen Beale. He is the Global Warming Campaign Director with Greenpeace. Welcome to Uprising, Stephen.
Hello.
Hi, thanks very much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
So there's a number of things to talk about. I want to start with the person who was just ousted, Representative Dingell, known to be progressive in many areas. But explain how he was essentially in the pocket of the big three automakers and what impact he has had over the years on American cars.
Well, sure. I mean, Representative Dingell, of course, represents the Dearborn, Michigan-based congressional district. It also includes Ann Arbor, but, you know, the heart and soul of that district going back to when he was first elected in the 1950s. And actually, his father, John Dingell Sr., represented the district before him back going back to the 1930s, I think. That district is, you know, the heart of the Detroit auto industry, and he has, you know, predictably been a champion of the auto industry and the United Auto Workers in all of their interests on Capitol Hill for decades, and that has led him to be a champion of a lot of issues that you know, that your audience, I'm sure, is very supportive of in terms of the United Auto Workers and labor rights and healthcare and whatnot. As you said, he's very progressive on a lot of issues. But unfortunately, it also, the auto industry has been, for many, you know, on many issues, really a head in the sand obstructionist force in terms of clean energy policy, global warming, clean air, and too often Representative Dingell has really lined up behind what the Detroit automakers have asked him to do. And a lot of that, you know, is coming home to roost right now in terms of the auto industry, unfortunately, being so far behind the times in terms of generating, building the next generation of fuel-efficient, energy-efficient vehicles and innovating. And so all of that together, I think, has, you know, led, is part of the reason why Congressman Dingell was less than, provided less than the leadership we would have wanted to see in terms of clean energy and global warming policy over the years.
Now, this is a pretty influential position, the House Energy and Commerce Committee chair. And, I mean, I think it's that his wife still works for GM, and I understand
Debbie
that.
Debbie Dingell is on the board of General Motors. And so, that one of the, you know, kind of inside the Beltway jokes is, you know, John Dingell is literally married to General Motors, and that's true, and he's been a huge recipient of campaign contributions. You know, and again, it goes back to the fact that he represents a district that is dominated by the auto industry, and auto workers are a huge constituency in his district. So none of this is any particular surprise.
And didn't he and his wife, at least up until a couple of years ago, own lots of stocks in the big three automakers?
I don't know that to be true, but I mean, she's, as a board member, it wouldn't surprise me at all.
So he's been the head of this committee for quite a while, and
sure.
Wouldn't you say that, I mean, some have, there's a pretty strong consensus that one of the major reasons why the automakers are failing so miserably right now, you know, begging for a bailout, is because they have not kept up with the times, because they have not created fuel-efficient cars that are a lot more lucrative these days, and in a way, John Dingell is partly responsible for the automakers being on the verge of bankruptcy by helping them in a way. He's helped them to bankruptcy.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that the people who have tried to defend the auto industry have in too many cases become enablers of the auto industry's dysfunction, without, you know, getting too psychoanalytical about it. But
Let's talk about Henry Waxman. What are his green credentials, and why is your organization, Greenpeace, celebrating at his position?
Congressman Waxman has been, for decades, one of the most effective, competent, bipartisan legislators for getting real results for clean energy, the environment, and many other issues that we've that the Congress has ever seen. I mean, his track record of successes from working across party lines under all political environment. He worked with Newt Gingrich in 1996 at the peak of the contract with America and all the rollbacks to the environment. He was able to work with Newt Gingrich to pass a reauthorization and significant strengthening of the Safe Drinking Water Act, shocking everyone. He was able to work with the first President Bush in 1990 to pass landmark reauthorization and strengthening of the Clean Air Act. He was able to work with President Reagan in 1986 to reauthorize and strengthen the Superfund law at a time when, you know, the Reagan administration was under indictment for failing to enforce and some real fraudulent activity in terms of their enforcement of the Superfund law, which cleans up the nation's most dangerous toxic waste sites. He was able to work with the administration to get past an important strengthening of that law, which included the creation of the Community Right to Know Act, which gives communities around the country basic information they need to know about the toxic emissions going into their community. Those are just three highlights of a track record of achievement that Congressman Waxman is responsible for that is literally saved tens of thousands, if not more, lives a year today that because of policies that Congressman Waxman is responsible for. And so that's why people are celebrating today in the environmental community, is because we have a champion at the head of this powerful committee who's proven the ability to get things done. And we need, the time for delay on global warming is over. The science says that if we don't get something done now, it's going to be, it's very soon, 5-10 years down the road. If we don't start making reductions now, it's going to be too late to prevent some of the most destructive and catastrophic impacts of global warming. And so we're celebrating, but it's not a moment too soon because we need to start getting results.
Well, how well poised is Waxman to help President-elect Barack Obama implement his green energy vision during his presidency? And how do you compare, the records of both of these? I mean, of course, Barack Obama doesn't have too much of a political record yet, but just in terms of what he said.
Yeah, I mean, I think Congressman Waxman is now positioned to be a tremendous ally to President-elect Obama in achieving an agenda for moving America towards a new energy future and taking and really dealing with global warming in a science-based way. He's going to be now in charge of the committee that will write the bill. And Congressman Waxman has some of the most capable and experienced staff on Capitol Hill. President-elect Obama has hired as one of his key liaisons to the Hill a gentleman named Phil Schillero, who previously was Congressman Waxman's point person on clean energy and the environment. And so these are the best, smartest, most effective people, and they are now right in the position where they're in a position to call the shots and write the law.
So basically, between Waxman and Obama, there should be no excuse for this country not taking steps towards a better environmental future.
Well, I don't think there was any legitimate excuse for the past leadership to have failed to address these needs, and so I don't want to, I think that the opportunity and the need is now, and I think that people have even more reason to be optimistic about our ability to tackle these problems today as they did yesterday.
My guest is Stephen Beal, Global Warming Campaign Director with Greenpeace. We're talking about Henry Waxman, California Democrat, and his new position with the as chair of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, ousting very longtime fellow Democrat John Dingell from that influential position. What does that say? What is the action that was just taken, Stephen, say about the Democratic Party in general as well? I mean, does it seem as though, the Democratic Party has come under a lot of criticism over the years, and certainly they're better on the issue of global warming than the Republicans, but are you optimistic that they may perhaps be growing somewhat of a spine these days?
I think that it says that the Democrats in the House of Representatives are ready to really start to get things done. They're ready to move beyond talking about what ought to be done, and they're ready to start actually legislating real solutions to global warming, really moving America towards a new energy future, and that is very incredibly exciting. There's always a tradition of deferring to seniority, etc. This is unusual what happened. I mean, you can't really underestimate it, and I think it says a lot about the commitment of the Democrats in the House of Representatives to real action now. Yeah, I do.
Well, Stephen Beal, where can listeners find out more information about what Greenpeace would like to see happening in this committee and also in the government in general under Barack Obama on the issue of global warming and other environmental initiatives?
Where can people go?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Greenpeace, www.greenpeace.org/USA is where folks can go to find out more information about our work and what we're looking for in terms of global warming and energy policy in the next Congress. Absolutely.
Greenpeace.org. Well, Stephen Beal, thank you very much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Stephen Beal is the Global Warming Campaign Director with Greenpeace. And that does it for today's program. For Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day, Edward Abbey once said, "Sentiment without action is the ruin of the soul." And that's Edward Abbey, and that's Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day. By the way, Uprising is looking for volunteers to help transcribe our interviews. If you have some free time once a week and would like to help us transcribe an interview, please do contact us at volunteer@kpfk.org. That's volunteer@kpfk.org. You are listening to Uprising. To get a CD of today's program, you can contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at pacificaradioarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Niall L. Wardani has been our volunteer intern for today, and Nadia Richardson is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of today's show on our website at kpfk.org/uprising. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks for listening, and have a wonderful weekend.